Welcome to The Context, the first and, as far as I know, only dramaturgy podcast in the universe. The whole universe.
Wow!
I know! We are really excited to be joined by Paul Draper today. And Paul Draper is a mentalist and a magician who is talking to us today because he's also a cultural anthropologist. And that combination really tickles my fancy. All of you over the podcast airwaves can't see his really magical magic book collection that I'm looking at right now. And I was informed that this is only your magic library, that there are more books elsewhere.
I even have books on dramaturgy and script supervising downstairs.
Bless your precious heart. So we are a brand new podcast. Paul, I'll be honest, I don't know what number episode this is going to be. I think three. I'll put up an appropriate tag at the beginning of the episode. But for our listeners at home, Paul is the first person that we have actually pushed the record button on for this podcast. And that means that you at home might not even know what the heck you're listening to right now. So I'm here to tell you, we are a dramaturgy podcast, but if you don't know what the heck dramaturgy is, that's okay. And if you're super excited about dramaturgy, even better. Welcome. Glad to have you. But I'm looking at how to connect audiences to creation and how we do this world building, both inside of the traditional theater space and outside of the traditional theater space. So Paul is really in it, right in my sweet spot of somebody who's deep into dramaturgy world, but also not really, you know, he's not working at a regional theater. He's not putting on Our Town. Paul, tell me, if you will, your journey from cultural anthropology into magic.
You know, it's funny because I started as a young boy fascinated with performing magic. That's where it all started because I wanted to have magical powers. And what a strange thing for someone in their day-to-day life wanting to have magical powers. And of course, I studied books at the local library on psychics and the paranormal and ghosts and belief and
ooh,
why we believe the weird things we believe. But it wasn't until I found the section of magic in the library in the kids section, which is 793.8 in the Dewey Decimal System, that I found these wonderful theatrical effects that when presented to others incorporated magic into their worldview, and suddenly magic is real in that moment, in that space between the performer and the spectator.
I want to ask, did that feel sufficient as a child who really wanted to have the magical powers? When you found out that you could sort of have the appearance of magical powers, that scratch the itch?
It was disappointing that I couldn't have the real powers,
but it
was wonderful that I had the exact same effect as having the real powers. And so suddenly the little kid that wasn't invited to birthday parties was now paid to come and perform at birthday parties.
Suck it, mean little kids.
That's right. So the Jewish kid and the Persian kid in Salt Lake City, Utah, finally got to play at the Mormon parties. My best friend was my assistant. Then when I went off to college, I originally went to study musical theater. And I wanted to be a musical theater actor. And I have been in touring productions and regional productions and summer stock productions. I've played off Broadway. I've played all over the world, and it's been wonderful. But I realized that theater wasn't going to cover, at least where I was studying, my interest in the depth of knowledge, human knowledge that is within these shows. I was interested in dramaturgy, but that wasn't an offering. So I became a cultural anthropologist, studying culture and religion and cognitive science, why we believe the weird things we believe, why we believe in magic, and how religion works. I studied with spiritualists in New Orleans and Navajo and Hopi in Arizona. I practiced to go work with the Bedouin of southern Iran. And throughout this, I paid my way through graduate school doing magic shows and mind reading shows, eventually teaching at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where was the perfect jump off spot to become the house magician at the Venetian Hotel and Casino. So I left. I left the world of cultural anthropology, realizing that as a professor, I wasn't given the opportunity to travel the world every week. I had to stay in my classroom, and there was also a cap on the income that I could bring in. So
okay, I've got a couple. I want to put a pin in all of this because there's so much I want to ask you about already. So as a dramaturg, being in a totally built world, like a fabricated world like the Venetian in Las Vegas, was that its own level of fascination for you, being somebody who got so deep into various cultures? What was it like being in fake Italy all the time?
Right, and being a fake Italian half of the time. So not only that, but in my early days there, they even had me be a fake Chinese wizard at Tao, like Dao nightclub, which this is something that today's culture would be seen as quite a horrible thing. But at the time, they hired
the Venetian me. Isn't even that old of a hotel,
right? That's
right.
That's right. At the Venetian, I had to pretend to be an Italian for about a third of my work there. So I had to pretend I was a man named Cesare from the island of Capri. Buongiorno, mi amici, mi chiamo Cesare. Amicia for you, canzone for you, sfumate, and so on. So the and then a third of the time I performed as a character, an artist dell'arte style character, and then a third of the time performed as myself in the suites for high rollers and what we call whales in Las Vegas, or celebrities, or anyone who came. But yes, when performing as Cesare on the floor, I tried to create that, Renaissance Italy creation in my table, in my the props that I used, in the lines that I used.
That's fantastic, and I think it's every dramaturg and director's wish that their performers would, on their own, get so deep into the world. But it's pretty rare from what I've seen, and I might just be, you know, I'm only speaking from my very own experience, but that's a really heartening thing to hear. Just as a person who's invested in the world that performers build for themselves.
It was really a great place to start working in Vegas, because I had the opportunity to live within so many pre-created worlds. I worked at Caesar's Magical Empire at Caesar's Palace, where we are Caesar's personal magicians. I worked at the Excalibur, where I performed as a British magician during the romanticized version of the medieval age, performed as a pirate magician even at Treasure Island. So it was really a wonderful place to do immersive, interactive, theatrical performances before I broke out. And where most of the time now, I'm performing for Apple computers and performing for huge companies in their generic banquet halls over and over again. Once in a while, I'm so lucky. This year, I performed for Dick Van Dyke's birthday party and performed for J.J. Abrams' Christmas party. But very often these days, I'm doing more work doing the Hallmark Channel Christmas special than I am themed entertainment.
That's fantastic. It's a what a lovely career path for a dramaturg.
Right.
Not a standard one, but I really enjoy it. Okay, so I want to get back a little bit to what you were saying about your fascination in religion and spiritualism and your study of that. How did your own religious tradition that you grew up with inform your desire to find the magic in these religions, or did it?
Right. I grew up Jewish in Salt Lake City, Utah. I was the one. They had a parade when I left.
Oh,
The
good for you.
but the no. We have Zion here. It's Jewtopia.
Oh, fantastic.
Utah. The no. Actually, I the nice thing about Judaism is it teaches a scholarly approach to the world and digging deeper and questioning all things. Not every religion has that, but certainly Reform and Conservative Judaism, those are focal points of the faith. And that was very nice. Very often, even at a very early age, there was only one synagogue in the state of Utah. Now there are
Oh,
five, I
wow.
think. But at the time, there was one. So whenever anyone did Fiddler on the Roof, Beau Jest, anything with Jewish characters or Jewish plots, they would call the one synagogue, and the one synagogue would send me to go and teach Judaism.
And was
Judaism.
that because you knew the most things? Was that because they knew you were a theater guy? How did you get to get
Right,
become the one?
because I was doing theater and I was studying. I was also at a very early age was teaching Judaic studies and history of Judaism in the Sunday schools, right? The week, the Monday, Wednesday, Sunday, and in Hebrew school. And so I was just a good candidate to translate religion to theater and theater to religion. Then, when I was doing that, I suddenly said to these theaters, also, if you ever need magic consulting for your production of Pippin, Godspell, The Wiz, Wizard of Oz, Damn Yankees, or even The Nutcracker, I'm available to do illusion and magic consulting.
Oh, that is so cool. And that's something that I want to make sure that our audience, who is probably largely dramaturgs and directors and themed entertainment nerds, if I had to guess, everybody's welcome to listen. But I bet that there are people who are interested in your magical consulting services now. And is that something that you still have in your up your sleeve?
Absolutely. It's good. In my hat, in my
In your
magic wand.
hat?
Yes, I bring that magic wand. This year I'm headlining at the Tennessee Theater Festival for high school theater students and
Oh,
also at the
cool.
Utah State Theater Festival. I still headline at some of these theater festivals, and I was a casting associate for Così fan tutte at the New York Metropolitan Opera this year.
Ooh.
They decided to do Mozart's Così fan tutte as a piece in Atlantic City at the turn of the last century, and they wanted fire breathers and snake charmers and strong men, and they brought me on to help cast those positions.
Oh, that is awesome. So I will make sure in show notes that we get your website and any contact information for you up there. So, oh Lord, what even is my website? I'm so green. Well, it's the Context podcast. I'm gonna have a bumper. This is what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna have a bumper at the top of the show and at the end of the show, and I'm going to articulate the logistical things in a much better way. But for right now, everyone in podcast land, welcome to my improvisational. I don't know what my website name is, right?
But
But
the
we will.
podcast is called Context.
It's called The Context. Yes.
Hi there, this is Paul Draper, mind reader and mentalist out of Las Vegas, Nevada, and you're listening to The Context. Learn about dramaturgy and everything associated with it.
Yeah, that sounded good. I
Of
think right now our official tag is the dramaturgy of everything awesome, and that might be just like a little bit too like internet nerd culture speak for my personal taste, but also I use the word awesome so much.
Everything is awesome.
It really is. Everything that isn't awful is awesome. And I also use the word dude quite a bit, being a Southern California native. I got to figure out how to brand myself with the appropriate amount of awesome and also dude.
That's good.
But I digress. We will get your information up on our website.com. So for folks who want to seek out your services and your expertise, even though you're a super fancy guy in the magic and mentalism community, you are still really, it seems like, very involved in this meaning-making community that, that dramaturgs often find ourselves in.
Yes, my favorite book in magic was by two religious scholars called Magic and Meaning by Eugene Berger and Bob Neal. And so, yeah, I love creating meaningful magic. Jeff McBride in Las Vegas still has the Magic and Meaning Conference yearly for magicians and scholars in our art. But if people want to reach out to me, the best place to catch me is at mentalmysteries.com or anthropologyoffice.com.
Anthropologyoffice.com. Ooh la la. Well, that sounds great. Okay. I'm really interested in more about making meaning through magic and with this spiritualism and religious context, because I'm not a magic insider. The meaning making part isn't something that I would have necessarily thought to look for. You know, when I think about the magic shows that I've been to, they've all been pretty bush league.
Right.
Like I think the fanciest one I went to was probably at the Orange County Fair when I was like 8 years old. So it was a lot of handkerchiefs tied together. Though I am always really interested in how magic does show up to create meaning in theater and in movies and in theme parks. And, you know, when it's sort of incorporated into these larger worlds, how do you create meaning with your magic?
It's a great question, and one that magicians are constantly struggling with. There was a time that magic was nothing but meaning. Mm-hmm. When we look back at the earliest written record of magic, it's from a thing called the Westcar Papyrus. It talks about a magician named Didi, D-I-D-I, who performed for Pharaoh Khufu. He cut the head off of a live bird, brought it back to life. Cut the head off of a live ox, brought it back to life. The pharaoh said, bring him a slave. And he said, no, I can't do it to a slave because a slave has a soul. And Didi was said to be able to eat multiple sides of beef and kegs of wine and dozens of loaves of bread per meal. And so it was, this is a time period when having magical powers was symbolism of both the ruler's power and the court of powerful people, but also control over life and death. Mm-hmm. We look at medieval and previous magicians and wizards and sorcerers who had powers to heal, powers to cure, powers to bring back the dead. It isn't until we start getting the King James burning of magicians and witches, right? That the discovery of witchcraft is written by Reginald Scott in the 1500s, saying, please stop killing us, we're just doing tricks. And then for a long period of time, magicians lost the religiosity that is connected in shamanism, lost the religiosity of the court wizard, and suddenly it became just the trickster, the individual who does tricks. There was a time the magicians were the medicine, the medicine man or woman, the pharmacist, the historian, the storyteller, the magician, all of the above. And for a long time, magicians were just the keepers of the deceptive secrets and illusions. So a lot of magicians now are trying to reach back into reforming themselves as a full theatrical wonder worker, instead of just making something appear for no reason, having it appear with or for deeper meaning, having something that you are hungry for, you desire, you need appear before your eyes, rather than just the random thing they can fit in their pocket.
That's so interesting. So thinking about people who did magic in antiquity, or not even necessarily antiquity, but even maybe as recently as like spiritualism in America in the late 1800s.
Or pre-industrial societies today.
Yes, yes. Is your impression from your study that your run of the mill magic doer had an awareness that they were holding on to the secrets to the tricks, or do you does it seem more to you that they had a belief in a system that allowed them to do things that were magical?
This is a very complex answer that I want to give a couple examples. First, with a pre-industrial magical physician. So there's the famous story of the sucking doctor is what they're called, that would come over to you and make a sucking sound near where you were feeling pain in your body. And then what they're doing is they're pulling the evil out of you, pulling the elf dart out of you, pulling the sickness out of you. And then they would reach into their mouth and pull out a wad of hair and blood and nastiness and say, "Here it is. Here's what I pulled out of you, and now you will get better." There have been anthropologists who have observed these sucking doctors and have seen them go out behind the tent, dig up a worm, stick it in their mouth, chew it up. Cut some of their hair off, stick their hair in their mouth, put a little mud in their mouth, bite their tongue to get a little bit of blood, hold that in their cheek, go over and suck the evil out. Then they pull that mass out and say, "Here it is. I've healed you." And clearly that individual knows that they put that in their mouth. Now, do they know that they are not actually pulling out something out of the person? When one sucking doctor was approached with this, his answer was, to the anthropologist who saw him do this, said, "Well, of course, that's what catches the evil. And I have to show that to them,
Oh.
because if I don't show that to them, they won't pay me because they can't see the sickness coming out of them." So is the individual deceiving? Are they doing what they've been told in the past? Do they believe that this thing, it's a big mix. Certainly the founders of the spiritualist movement, the Fox sisters in upstate New York, they knew that they were making clicking sounds with their toes, but their mother and their father and the people who created the religion around these young women, they thought it was real. So what is so who do we blame? And it was, amazingly enough, spiritualism was the fastest growing religion in the world at one point, including such members as Arthur Conan Doyle, the writer of Sherlock Holmes, Alfred Russel Wallace, who was the co-creator of the theory of evolution with Darwin.
Oh, that's
These
interesting.
are Even Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, held seances in the White House. So it was enormously successful, and yet started with many magic tricks.
That is so interesting. And I think too about, there is a little bit of an echo of that today. I mean, I know that there are still people who rely on empaths and other folks who can talk to ghosts or feel your feelings or do somewhat magical things to help people through their problems. And I wonder the sort of the same, what is your take on that sort of subset of folks who have a message for you from your great grandma Miriam?
Right. I think for a lot of people, they have a best friend to talk to. If they don't, they have a therapist to talk to. If they don't, they have a bartender to talk to. If they don't, they have a chat group online to talk to. And if they don't, they have a spiritualist medium. They pay $25 to read their cards. I think all of these have benefits of working for you, depending upon what it is you're looking for. Now, as soon as the person moves into your house and wants $100,000 a year to have your grandma tell you, your dead grandma tell you what you need to remove from your diet so you don't die, I think, well, now they're harming people. But I'm not ready to stand up and say this group has a living prophet that talks to God, And so they're good, bad, sideways.
Right.
This group has speaking in tongues and hands on healing and power of prayer. So they're good, bad, or otherwise. I'm going to let people make those choices. Certainly, I don't think atheists are either worse off or better off. But I think that religion does provide a great deal of community and answers for how to get by in a tough world, collected over time.
Yep, that makes so much sense to me. And from my own background is I was raised in an evangelical Christian church in Orange County, California, and I still have I'm not part of that community anymore, but I still know a lot of people who are,
you still like Christmas and Easter.
I still love Christmas and Easter. They're fantastic. But something that's been very interesting with that evangelical community is as people have fallen away from, you know, our mega church that we grew up in, there are some folks who've taken the, you know, like a gift of discernment, as I think what we call it. And so there's a little bit of like a little bit of the standard mega church doctrine, but there's a lot of ghost talk that's kind of come in. So it's interesting because it seems like an offshoot of an extreme but also pretty mainstream in America religious upbringing, it's funny, I hadn't really thought about it in terms of meaning making and magic until having this conversation with you.
You know, we haven't seen any new pictures of Bigfoot lately, and I hope he's okay. You know, don't you?
I do. Right. I hope he's going to make it.
the same with the Loch Ness monster. I mean, there'd have to be at least a certain number of them to keep it going, and we just haven't seen a good picture of it in the wild. So I'm nervous about Nessie and Bigfoot. I hope they're somewhere and they're doing well.
Yeah. Yep. And
we all have our beliefs, and I think the beliefs are good as long as they're beliefs that help us in life and help us to live better lives and kinder lives and treat people better, mm-hmm. and that don't cost us more money than we can afford.
Right.
And so I've seen people who their religion is famous music stars or famous movie stars, and I think that that's just as painful. But my world is to create the theatrical recreation of the spiritualist movement. Mm-hmm. I want to create theatrical shows. I have a mind reading show, and in it I do use some skills that I've developed in life for real, skills of lie detection and skills of verbal manipulation and super memory and some of these real skills mixed in with magic tricks, because if you put in a little bit of a truth into the lie, it becomes so much more real. But at the end of my show, a lot of mentalists have what are called disclaimers. It's funny, if you go to a production of Peter Pan, Mary Martin doesn't have to stop and say, "Hey, everybody, let me just tell you for a second, I'm a girl and I'm not really flying. This was set up by Foy, and fairies aren't real." But in a mind reading show, mentalists feel that it's an ethical imperative that we step up and give some sort of disclaimer, because otherwise audiences may think we're real and want to burn us at the stake. I've had theatrical shows that I've put on at historic theaters around the nation. I did a 2-year tour of historic theaters in the U.S. I have had local evangelical groups picket my show, thinking that I was doing sorcery of the devil.
That is interesting. That is very interesting. And I definitely grew up in one of those churches that would have been there picketing, because we couldn't have Count Chocula when I was growing up because of the Count's alignment with the dark forces. So that's kind of just what was happening. But it's also interesting that there are that expectation would be there for something that has all of the same conventional trappings as a production of Peter Pan. So the other side of that, do you find, apart from not wanting to be burned at the stake, which I can't blame you, do you find that people are otherwise, without the disclaimer, coming to you for like serious counseling and spiritual advice.
I, at just about every public show I perform, I will have someone come up and ask me about a dead relative, or ask me to read their thoughts for real, or determine what degree they should take. I have political leaders come up to me for tarot readings and ask me if they're going to win this election. So yes, these things happen. That's why I end my show with the classic piece of magic known as the Linking Rings, while singing a song from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory called Pure Imagination, because I can then say, I am so glad you enjoyed the theatrical show that I put on. And just like the last piece I did with a classic magic trick that comes in every child's magic kit, the Linking Rings, and I sang Pure Imagination, this was a journey of our imagination. I have made that a stronger statement since a few years ago, a friend of mine was in South America on a news program, and the news anchor lit him on fire on live television for being a sorcerer.
Oh my. Is your friend okay now?
He is okay now,
Whoa.
but suffered pretty terrible burns.
That is really horrifying. Stay
And
safe out there, man.
that's not a stranger in the that's not a stranger in the street. That is a television news anchor on live TV.
Oh wow, that hurts my feelings. And it sounds very, very serious.
So next time you see a production of Man of La Mancha, it's time to take Dr. Carrasco out and light him on fire.
Right, absolutely. Well, obviously, I've got to cleanse the area of the evil and
Night of the Mirrors, yeah.
Okay, so personal safety is a big component of your work, it sounds like. Interesting. So what do you think made magic, like magic shows and magic tricks and magic without the spirituality, continue to have a market after, particularly right after, witches started getting burned? What do you think was the drive for that to continue, both from
Because
an audience and from a performer perspective?
magic is still delightful. I mean, even if there isn't a story, magic is still wonderful. When something vanishes in front of your eyes, or transforms into something else, or you make life appear out of nowhere—a dove or a rabbit—life, right? Or coins, money, something of value just appears from nowhere when apparently you can peer into someone else's mind. The performer doesn't have to be all that good for that to still be engaging. If someone hits do re mi, if they hit their notes correctly, they don't have to be singing something particularly engaging in a small community for that to persist and them to be the best singer that that community has ever heard. I remember I was doing some magic and interacting once with Stephen Sondheim, and I asked him how a singer should sing his songs, and he said, "Hit the notes as written." I also asked him if he had any advice for me as a writer writing for magic shows, and he said, "Do what your junior high English teacher told you. Say what you're going to say. Say it. Say what you said." And I laughed and I said, just like you, and I said, "Give me an example in one of your shows where you did that." And he said, "All right, one of the first shows I worked on outside of college, West Side Story. Tonight, tonight, I'll meet my love tonight. Marie." Then he meets Maria. "Maria, I just met a girl named." So he's gonna meet her. He meets her. He just met her.
Yeah, wow. That's exactly how it goes.
And so a magic show is wonderful visually, and it's even better when it can have those theatric qualities and can add dance and music and movement and story. What made Doug Henning, who did was the most successful show on in Broadway's history in its time, Doug Henning's The Magic Show, what made that a success was that it had a storyline, had a character that we cared about, going through things that we ourselves have experienced. He then did Merlin with Cheetah Rivera, Nathan Lane, and Christian Slater in Merlin on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And he had 8 NBC specials. Then David Copperfield took over the scene and had incredible stories to go with the magic that he created. One of the things that made David famous was his vanishing of the Statue of Liberty, which Doug Henning, the bigger star at the time, was offered first, and he refused to do it because he thought the story of a Canadian who had immigrated to America making the Statue of Liberty vanish was the wrong story for him to be telling. Where David Copperfield, David Kotkin, a Jewish kid from Chicago, he felt very strongly about that he could make it vanish and reappear, mm-hmm. and do it with a story about his family being immigrants to this country. And so it's better when I have an effect in close-up when I perform at the Magic Castle in Hollywood or the Magic Circle in London. There's an effect, an old effect, with a little pillbox that you put 50-cent pieces in, and the 50-cent pieces vanish. On its own, it's a lovely little piece. But when I talk about walking around the Navajo Nation with an Apache shaman who used this piece of magic as a life lesson to show some local Navajo that they needed to stop drinking, this is a true story that really happened to me, mm-hmm. to live better lives for themselves and their families, and that if they didn't, they would be lost in the maze, like the man in the maze, their symbol of being lost and trapped within that maze that we create for ourselves. Mm. Ah, now suddenly, while I play the Diné flute or the Ute flute, suddenly, when I play the Diné flute or the Ute flute and I tell this story, suddenly the magic has so much more meaning.
Mm. Yeah. that's really great. And I really appreciate that you've held on to the cultural anthropology aspect of your interest. And I saw too in this article in Mum magazine that I read about you right before we started recording, you got advice from another magician early on about how to be a good magician, and it was to do with reading.
Yeah. This is a very famous mentalist named Max Maven, who his background was mathematics, and his parents were both physics professors. There's an image of him as a baby being held by Einstein, and he was a regular performer for Orson Welles and Mike Tyson and Muhammad Ali, and I went up to him as a young man when I was a young man, and I said, "What advice do you have for a young budding mentalist who wants to be like you? I'm sure that you give advice all the time. You have a standard piece of advice that you give." And he said, "Read everything." And I said, "Read everything old, read everything new, read everything red, read everything blue. What do you mean read everything?" And he said, "Had I felt it required more words, I would have utilized them. You're a pest, go away." We are now friends. As adults, but at the time, he was so inundated by young 16, 17, 18-year-old magicians that he could not walk 10 steps at a magic convention without somebody asking him questions or copying everything he did. So I understand. But his advice of read everything, and by that, not just everything within our art, but everything in the world. Be a person of the world and engaged in the world and engaged in philosophy and religion and politics and everything that can inspire and speak to what you're doing. Because we are given a blessed right, a sacred position that I have the opportunity to stand in front of my fellow human beings and have their rapt attention for 45 minutes to an hour at a time, I better have something to say.
And you're known for you know, not just audience engagement in a gimmicky sense, but with really engaging with your audience members and trying, it seems like to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but trying to know them as people, to get them to know themselves and each other a little bit better.
So many magicians just use people as props.
Mm-hmm.
I never liked in theater having the fourth wall that the audience is merely a voyeur into. I loved the breaking of the fourth wall and the Ben Vereen stepping out in Pippin and saying, "Join us," right? Looking us in the eye and letting us know that we are to be a part of this. I like shows that are fully immersive, engaging, require the interactivity of the audience. Now, not every audience likes that.
Mm-hmm.
But at a recent historic theater show I did in Wisconsin, we sold out the day before the show, and I told them to keep selling tickets because we're going to fill the stage. Excuse me. We're going to fill the stage with audience members. So we put chairs all the way around me on the audience so that these people are visually a part of the show. I just saw last year Josh Groban's The Great Comet, where the audience is on stage and they're given instruments and they're given pierogies to eat, and they are part of that experience. And I love theater like that.
That's fantastic. I saw too that when you ask people, you know, where are you from, that if they say I'm from San Antonio, you want to be able to have something to talk to them about where they're from. And can you tell me a little bit about how you get to know your audience when you're not doing a show, how you prepare yourselves to know them or prepare yourself to know them?
Absolutely. I'm amazed at how many touring performers I know that when they hit a town, they go to their hotel, they watch TV in their hotel room, they go down to the hotel bar and get drunk. How many entertainers I know that work on cruise ships and they just stay in their room or go to the employee bar and get drunk and just stay there, and they don't engage with the world around them. Everywhere I travel, I see it as a real great opportunity to go and see the local zoo, the local museum, the local botanical garden, the local aviary. And even in a small town, they have something. Every town has the thing. Who knows what the thing will be? Maybe it's the dinosaur tracks at the Johnson Farm off Route 10. Maybe it's the llama farm. Maybe it's the local Hare Krishna temple. But every town has a giant Abe Lincoln or a giant ball of thread or the suicide rock where people paint their love to each other on the rock. And I like to visit those places wherever I go and engage with the people there and record that in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone else says that they're from here, there, or the other place, that I can talk about the River Walk, or I can talk about the Alamo, or I can talk about whatever aspect of that town, be it food or culture, that struck my mind to say, I care about you and where you come from.
I really love that. I'm a museum person as well as a theater person, and I think that's such a huge part of the work of getting to know people and places is going to see the ball of twine, man. You got to see that ball of twine. It's all the same thing. I really look forward to going to whatever the thing is, whenever I go somewhere.
In Las Vegas, I helped design the Las Vegas Spring Preserve and some exhibits within the Natural History Museum and the Sustainability Gallery within that multi, I think, 40-acre property. And if I didn't have the mix of magic, theatrical design, and anthropology, I wouldn't, and my interests in everything everywhere, I wouldn't be able to do that work.
Mm. I like it. You've given me so much to work with today and so much to think about. Is there anything that you want to make sure that our podcast audience of dramaturgs, theater people, interested others, world builders, anything that they should know
about whenever you? Whenever we can make our audiences feel a member of what is happening on stage, whenever we can do that, either as they're an individual and they are literally playing a part, or it's something relatable to them that they have experienced, or they know someone who's experienced, we can make deeper, more human connections. And of course, we know that. The second thing is, from a magician's mindset, anything is possible. Anything you dream is possible. And there are brilliant people who have worked on these problems, and there are simpler ways to do it than you're thinking. So often when I go to a theater and I see that they've tried to accomplish something magical without a magic creator, they're utilizing giant holes in the stage and hydraulics and electronics, and they've programmed Adrenos when they could have used a magnet and a stick. So there are experts out there who have found easier ways to do it, and anything is possible. I live in the world of making dreams reality, making someone fly, vanish, transform, know things that are impossible to know. And if you ever have a production that needs help with that, I would love to help you.
Oh man, it sounds like you would save them so many tens of thousands of dollars because you've got the know-how about the magnet and the stick.
Right.
From a purely financial perspective, that is hugely valuable. Awesome. Thank you so much, Paul Draper, for talking with us today and for being our first recorded guest on The Context. We loved having you.
So thanks so much for having me. And people can follow me at mentalmysteries.com, sign up for my newsletter at mentalmysteries.com, or follow me on social media just by typing in Paul Draper Magician. Make sure to get me and not the singer out of the UK.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for joining us today on The Context Podcast. You can learn more about our guest and the topics we covered today by heading to thecontextpod.com. That's thecontextpod.com for exclusive bonus content, including monthly episodes and secret Spotify playlists and some other cool stuff. Become a subscriber by going to patreon.com/thecontextpod. You can also follow along with our adventures on Twitter, where we are at Context Pod, and you can email us all your questions and episode ideas and thoughts and other things, just no dick pics, at thecontextpod@gmail.com. This episode of The Context was made possible by the 2018 Dramaturgy-Driven Grant from the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. Learn more about membership and how you could maybe get a grant for doing a thing you like at lmda.org/join. They don't require me to thank them, but it's a good group of folks, and I'm glad to be involved. They also don't require me to tell you that everything said on this podcast is my own opinion and not necessarily the views of LMDA, but that's also true. I don't think that LMDA would put dick pics in their closing bumper as a phrase to say. Anyway, that's all on me, not on them. Thanks for joining.